Building and maintaining a creative process that uniquely positions you has many advantages. In this episode, I talk to award-winning advertising maven, marketing executive, speaker, and author, Kaya Dlanga, about his creative process.
I always wonder if you like something because you're good at it, or you become good at it because you like it.
As a marketing and communications executive for brands like Rain, Coca-Cola, and Heineken, Kaya has been instrumental in shaping brand messaging, communication, and fostering collaborations with these brands and their agencies.
But then at the same time, you have clients who are very egotistical, who the work is about, you are serving me, it's about me, and therefore I'm always right, and they don't like to be challenged. But then when things go wrong, it's the agency's fault.
We venture into how he built communities around himself, his views on brand and agency collaborations, as well as his new YouTube channel, Leave a Message with Kaya Dlanga.
The worst thing I think you can do is not to participate in something because you're a bit worried about, I don't know, whatever it is, that I don't have a good enough camera, or don't have a good enough computer, I don't have a good enough this. You just do it. And equipment is the biggest excuse anybody can give themselves. It sounds logical, right? So, and this is a problem with excuses that are extremely logical, and they make sense, and you are not wrong when you make them. But also, it is how you handcuff yourself.
Please share and subscribe to The Lead Creative wherever you get your podcasts. It helps us to bring you amazing guests, share their insights, and to spread the word. Enjoy the show. Welcome to The Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Mongezi Mthathi. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Kaya, thank you so much for making the time to chat with us on The Lead Creative. What an honor. I've been following your work a lot, and I've been seeing a lot of the stuff that you've been doing, and I know that, you're still at it. So it's really cool to be talking to you.
No, thank you for inviting me, and hopefully I won't disappoint.
Yes. You absolutely won't. I'm sure you won't. You've accomplished a lot in advertising, communication, and as an author as well, right? What's the one piece of advice or an idea that you keep going back to kind of create the things that you do? Like, what's that one thing that keeps you grounded and keeps you going?
I think for me, the one thing I would say, just for advice to anybody, not just for me, it's like curiosity. It's just to be in a constant state of curiosity, trying to find out things you don't know about, finding out more about things that you know about, that you know, and to never really think that you know everything in whatever it is that you're doing, because that's when you get, you know, to a state of being quite complacent, because you have led yourself to believe that. You know, Michelangelo, there's a quote about Michelangelo, and I think he was 92 or 92, 93 when I was quoted saying this, and he said, "I'm still learning." This is like a 92-year-old man who is considered a master, you know, who's invented all these new techniques in terms of like carving marble. He has painted a Sistine Chapel. He's just done these incredible things. And he's, designed like the Dome, I think, St. Peter's or something like that. And this is a person who was a master in multiple disciplines, who still says at 92 years old, is like, "I'm still learning." And for me, that is a state of curiosity. And when I feel I have lost it and I haven't done as well as I could have, is when I've really lost that curiosity bone. And when I've allowed myself to lose curiosity. So that is the one piece of advice I'd give to anybody. Don't let that die.
How do you generate inspiration, or at least come up with ideas? I mean, a lot of some people I've spoken to, especially creative minds who are constantly working, or are constantly releasing material, or constantly releasing books, very much like you are constantly working and releasing content. They talk about the idea of inspiration being overrated, that if you sit down and do it and do the work, inspiration will find you sometimes and sometimes it won't, but actually you need to keep doing the work. How would you describe your creative process, from writing books to creating content to working with brands?
I agree with them. I mean, they're right. In fact, I don't believe in such a thing as inspiration. And I don't even think it exists. Maybe you could say it exists in the sense that when you have like a sudden burst to do something and then you never do something again. And maybe how I would define inspiration maybe is like a trigger. So where you see something and then it triggers, you know, a chain of events that lead you to a certain idea. And so that's why I wouldn't really look at it as inspiration. And I think, and what I always say to people is, if you wait to be inspired, you're going to wait forever. And the real work, writing a book is not in, there is no inspiration as ever when you're writing a book, because it is slog. You know, you're writing 120,000 words, you're writing 80,000, 90,000 words, and every letter you have to type, you have to sit down and you write. You have to make sure that the order makes sense and that what you are trying to say comes out as intended, you know, to come out. Those things do not require inspiration. There's another lady, I forget who it was now, who said, I hate writing, but I love having written. So it's understanding that the process is not, there's nothing glamorous about the process, and welcoming that and being grateful for the reward at the end of it. So have the output. The process itself, yes, I think there are parts where you're like, oh, this, I mean, I know when I write sometimes, it's like, and I'm like, oh man, I loved that moment or that paragraph, that was great. But the rest of the time, I'm like, okay, you're just writing. You don't have time to think, oh, that's amazing. It's just creating.
Yeah. How would you describe your creative process in that? Because I get this sense, of course, that you just get down to it, right? You understand that there's the slog, the hard work that has to happen for you to get to those 120,000 words, each of which you need to write. And it has to happen, and you do it consistently, depending on I suppose time and whatever it is. But how would you describe your process? Like, if you are writing a book, for instance, how's your process versus if you are generating a new idea or kind of working on those kinds of things?
Okay, the process is this. Okay, maybe my publisher says, again, let me give you an example of like my second book, because to quote myself, my publisher approached me. They're like, they saw this interview that I'd done, and they said, you have a great story to tell, and can you write about it? And I was like, I can't be writing about my life. I mean, what's this? I'm not Mandela. I didn't spend time in prison, and I didn't cure cancer. I didn't invent like some crazy thing. So I don't know why I should be writing about my life. That process kind of took 2 years for them to talk to me. Well, eventually, what they convinced me was that it's precisely because my life is ordinary that I need to write, and it's quite relatable. And a lot of people who have lived the life that I have, who have never seen their story written in a book, and I've got the platform to do it. And therefore, I was like, oh, okay, well, finally, you twisted my arm. So, and the process was very, very simple. And I believe in this process so much. It's like, okay, great. I'm writing a book about my life. So A, how do I want to write it? So I have to think about that, the process. Is it, should I write it chronologically or should I write it according to events in my life? What perspective am I going to write it in? Is it first person? All of those kinds of things that I have to think about. And then what you do after that is you write each, okay, it's the beginning. Okay, the beginning, I write about who I was born. Do I write about my birth or do I write about the area from which I come from? So I'm like, all right, let me describe the place, the area I was born in, what it looks like. So to kind of paint the picture. And for there, that that's what inspired the how I wrote the first chapter in that book was a book written by Alan Payton, which was Cry the Beloved Country. And also how he opens Cry the Beloved Country is him describing a couple where the story is set up. And also for me, like I was like, okay, that's what I need to do. Let me describe where I come from. And so the process was, okay, in the beginning. So what I say is I will write a synopsis. A synopsis could be a paragraph, could be a sentence. Chapter one, where I come from. Chapter two, oh, there's a kitchen that I remember, you know, my grandmother, you know, when I was a young boy. So it's like, I'll be describing the kitchen. Chapter three, my mother, you know, what she was like. Chapter four, my father dying, you know, when I was 6 years old. Seven. So, but you kind of like really, so that you are very clear about each chapter that you're going to write. So that you don't just find yourself, you know, I don't know, being blown or being all over the place. So you need to be quite specific. And the second thing that I do once I've written this synopsis is I then get down to the basics, which is, okay, great. I don't give myself, I make it very easy for me to write. And what I mean by that is I will say, okay, for the first month that I'm writing, I tell myself that every day I am going to write 100 words. That doesn't seem like a lot. It's a very achievable goal. And that's what I want to do. So I don't want to feel like, oh my goodness, I have to write 1,000 words. And then it seems very daunting. But if I say 100 words and I say, but the end of the month is going to be 3,000 words, that adds up. You know, it's a lot. But what I also know is that I will write more than 100 words most of the time. And therefore, so I feel accomplished because I set a very low benchmark. Let me put it this way, so that I can achieve it. And I think one of the problems maybe with some people, young creatives or people who are taking large projects, is that they just set these gigantic milestones that really weigh down on them. And in order for you to be able to really achieve things quickly and is to set these very, very, very easy to achieve targets. And because you feel accomplished, you will do more than you told yourself to do. And that is my process. And it's me cheating my mind so that I can have more endurance.
Yeah. There was a time around, I would say, the 2010s, 2012s, when you were writing a lot across very many platforms, writing a lot of articles. I just want to almost go back to that time and juxtapose it against this, you lowering the bar for yourself deliberately. Because you come from a time when you were writing 1,200 word articles, thought pieces on the likes of Thought Leader and all of those places, right? So you come from that time and that level of writing. So I want to go back there because as an outsider, I would say, yes, you lower the bar for yourself to write 100 words a day for 30 days. But you are also, to me, you are also a writer. You are also a creative mind that has done this for a very long time. So if you set that bar for yourself, if you miss the 5 days, it's easy for you to write 1,000 words because you've done it over and over again, right? So how would you then, I think, urge or at least advise someone who is starting on that journey or on the early stages of that journey where they don't have the muscle memory of having written 1,000-word thought pieces in the past?
Okay. I mean, that's it's a good point. And I would say that I don't understand someone who would try to embark on a massive project like writing a book and you haven't given yourself any muscle memory. And what I always say is that there is no, like people say, there's no such thing as overnight success. You know, I didn't wake up one day and I wrote a book, like you're saying. Before that, in high school, I was writing essays. And I suppose I discovered my writing bone by accident. And I don't know if it's because I always wonder if you like something because you're good at it or you become good at it because you like it. In my instance, we were asked by our teacher to write, to describe a moment. So he put a video of a building imploding. That's what I'm saying, that I don't understand people who just want to embark on a massive project without having put in that work previously, right? In order to train your muscle memory, as you mentioned it. And for me, when I think about back in school, is you know, my love for writing, which is, I think I tried to say this earlier, is that I don't know if you become good at something because you like it or you like it because you're good at it. When I was in school, my English teacher made us watch a video of a building imploding. And what we had to do was to describe what you see, what is happening, just describe that moment. There's no dialogue. You're just describing what you're seeing. And I wrote, you know, this, you know, about the dust and the, you know, the cracking of the building. And, you know, all of those things. And I'm kind of a long descriptor. And I got the highest mark in the class. And I'm like, what, one of three black kids in the class. And the white kids are a bit like, what the heck? And this was back in the day. It's like, oh, okay, wow. So, and because I got the highest mark in the class, I was like, oh, okay. Then I kind of made a bit of an effort. But also before that, I'd started enjoying reading before I wrote this book, you know, before I wrote that essay. So that I had like, because my mom had kind of forced me to start reading, and I was really enjoying reading. And therefore, because I enjoyed, so I feel like you can't be a good writer if you're not a good reader. So I enjoyed reading a lot. And then I suppose because I'd read so much, by the time I was to write and describe that thing, it kind of, that massive memory from reading other writers came through to play and I was able to do that. And so throughout my school career, I was now consistently getting the highest mark in the class whenever I wrote essays. So I had that. And so now when I started writing, when I was invited to actually write for Mill and Garden Thought Leader, I was like, I mean, I'm a copywriter. I was a creative. And the longest thing I used to do write when I was a creative was a 30-second radio spot or a 60-second radio spot. Maybe one long copy here and there, you know. I mean, there was one long copy ad that I wrote that, you know, won this freaking major awards. And that was the only longest thing I'd ever done in my life. So now when I was asked to write, I felt so insecure because I was like, but I'm not used to writing long form. So why? How would I write? And so I wrote my first thought leader column. And what happened with that? I mean, they had about a roster of 40 or 50 writers. And I'll never forget because they would rank, you know, your article. My article that very first week was number one most read article. I was like, what the heck? I'm a nobody. How is this happening? All right. And so I wrote the next week. And, you know, I was writing for free for 52 weeks. I was publishing a piece, not getting paid anything, for 52 weeks.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show. I want to come back to this idea a bit later because there's something that comes to mind for me about building a community, which I want to ask you a bit later. So I want to almost park this a little bit now here because it is about, I think, this idea of storytelling and which you've managed to do over time, not just telling the stories that you were writing about and telling the story of your life through the books you wrote, but also the story of yourself, which then spread across the industry and across the industries that you've managed to touch. I want to come back to that idea a bit later on. One thing that you built a lot and you were the early adopters of, rather, from early on was, of course, social media and contributing across various social media channels, various social media platforms. I've noticed that you've stayed ahead of these trends. You've stayed ahead of social media trends. You've stayed ahead of trends, I don't know whether deliberately or in some instances by accident. And you can tell us, which side of that you fell on. But how do you stay ahead of these trends and make the kinds of impact that you did? You mentioned curiosity earlier, and I'm sure curiosity contributed, but what else would you say contributed to you staying ahead of these trends?
I find out about whatever new thing is up, and I want to know what this is about, and I want to be involved. Literally, that's it. So I don't think too much about it. So the worst thing I think you can do is not to participate in something because you're a bit worried about, I don't know, whatever it is, that I don't have a good enough camera, or don't have a good enough computer, I don't have a good enough this. You just do it. And equipment is the biggest excuse anybody can give themselves. It sounds logical, right? So, and this is a problem with excuses, that they're extremely logical and they make sense and you are not wrong when you make them. But also, it is how you handcuff yourself and prevent yourself from doing what it is that you wish to do. I forget your question now.
Staying ahead of the trends. I think you partly answered it, that when you know of something or you find out that something is happening, you jump into it sometimes not as strategically as people sometimes think you might have back.
Okay, let me give you an example about Twitter.
Yeah.
I had no idea what this thing was when it started. So, and I remember I tweeted 3 or 4 times and I was like, I don't understand this thing. Okay, I'm done. I stopped doing it because I just couldn't get it. And I went to some conference where some guy said to me, listen, I am Twitter. I said, yes, but I don't understand that thing. And he said, it was very different to what it is now. And he said, you know what? Please, I think you'd be really good at it. So do me a favor. For 1 week, just do this for me. For 1 week, tweet 2-3 times a day. Just for 1 week, just do that. And you will eventually figure it out. And I was like, okay, whatever. And then I started, I'm starting tweeting. I'm talking to myself. Oh, and then I discover things and people. Oh, you act. This is how you respond to a person. Oh, and then this is, you know. And it was developing as Twitter was transforming right in front of my eyes. Sure. There was a thing called RT that was starting to develop, that was happening when you're retweeting somebody and so on and so forth. And that was, for example, RT was developed by the community itself. It was something that Twitter had developed. The community created it. And so, and I think for me, it's just being involved. It's not because I'm trying to be ahead of the curve. It's just that I'm curious about this new thing and I want to be part of it. And and to keep my mind sharp, for example, even when I started off as a creative, one of the things I remember working my first job, and this was before social media and all of that, and people would send these emails about maybe some funny joke, but it's an email or some story. And then I started writing my own. And my thing was to see if it would ever come back to me at some point. Someone would send something, and eventually this kind of email. And then a few would come back to me, and I was like, oh my word, my thing is happening, you know, I'm writing something and it's being distributed and appreciated. And then I remember going, a friend of mine, he actually passed away last week. May his soul rest in peace. I was at the AAA starting with this guy at the AAA, and he invited me to go watch him do stand-up comedy. I'd never been to a stand-up comedy show in my entire life, and I was doing open mic. There's a place called the Comedy Warehouse, literally down the road from where I'm staying, here in Cape Town.
Yeah.
And I went to this place, and it does this gigantic hall, almost like a beer hall of some kind, with a stage. And I went to the Comedy Warehouse, I watched it. I remember watching these comedians perform. I was like, I can be funnier than these guys. And then I was like, where do I go to learn to be a comedian? Because I was like, I'm a copywriter and my job is words. Sure. It's what I do every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I can be conceptual with my words. And I find, so how I was criticizing them, I was like, the jokes are too easy. They're not that conceptual. I'm sure I can do better.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I found a place called the Comedy, Cape Comedy Collective, a whole bunch of comedians. You sit around as a, would go, I think it was every Tuesday. I don't remember, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. I don't know. Would sit for about 2 hours, and each comedian would stand up. You'd have written the material you wanted to work on, and you tell the jokes in front of other comedians, and they're like, actually, no, I think you should do this. Nah, I don't think that works. Oh, I think this works.
Yeah.
And you get that feedback. And then I went to a few of those, and then the guy who was running the Cape Comedy Collective, then I was like, okay, you're ready for stage. I went to the Independent Armchair Theater, and that's how I performed. So it's just... So the story, what I'm trying to tell, I'm not telling stories and never answering, but I think what I'm telling.
No, I think, I got the gist of it. And so, I think I want to kind of stick with that. It's this idea of, I guess, yes, curiosity, as you mentioned, but also jumping into things headfirst as they launch, as they happen, without sometimes.
Fix it as it goes.
You know, exactly. Just, yeah. I think for me, build the plane as you fly.
It's like understanding that because I'm starting this thing, I'm not going to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Expect yourself to do terribly, right? And not give up because you're doing terribly. Doing terribly is an opportunity for you to get better next week, you know? And that's how I see it. It's like, okay, I get on stage the first time. I can tell that I'm getting sympathy laughs, right? It's not like... Mm. Proper loves this. And because they mentioned, they're like, oh, his first time on this stage ever. And then audience is
So prime yourself for him to not be very funny, but pretend he is.
Exactly. So, but then the more I went on this stage, the more comfortable I got, the more I understood things like timing. So when you tell a joke, and it's not just like, just be funny. It's like, okay, how you deliver the line, when you deliver it, when you pause, how long you pause for, or if you shout and all of that. You learn them by doing and being on that stage.
Yes, yes.
Go ahead. So I'm saying when you do that, that is the, so what I'm saying is that, so how do I keep my process is that, for me, it's my inability to just do one thing, I think, as a creative person.
Okay.
So I was a copywriter, and while as this junior guy, I was writing this, trying to create these email things, you know, trends that would be passed around, or I would... and then I found comedy, and then I did stand-up comedy, because I cannot do one thing. So my soul needs to do more than the job that I'm doing.
So how did this sense, or the sense of adventure, of diving in headfirst, of curiosity, of following trends, translate into the brand and marketing insights, as well as the brand work that you were doing?
Yeah, I think It's hard to say, but I think because you are doing a lot and experiencing life rather than reading it from a strategy document or a research document, the impact of the work you create is much more meaningful, I think. And I think that's literally how it helped. And I think that's what helped me, because I was doing a lot. I was reading, I was meeting lots of people. And I do think that some of the most creative people, whether they are antisocial or not, but because they are feeding, they're constantly feeding themselves. Mm-hmm. That's the only way they're able to create the kind of work they're creating. Because yes, some people are like, some creative process is just, you can just be an observer. You don't need to participate in anything that, you know, that can be done. But I personally feel that in living in the world and participating in the world is really what helped me understand insights to create the kind of work when I was a creative, I was able to do. And then when I was a strategist, the kind of strategies I was able to come out, and then being a client, I was able to judge the work that was presented to me, was because I'm an active participant in the world. I'm not just like an observer sitting in an office.
Yes. You of course then moved out of agency into the brand space, moving into Coca-Cola and many other brands thereafter. What did you realize about the nature of brand and agency collaborations when you were on the brand side?
That's a very good
could either question. Have been improved or changed.
I'll tell you, for me, I think there is a massive mistrust between the two. So there's a massive gulf between the two. And my biggest frustration when it comes to, for example, I'll never forget when I started working and now I'm a client, I'm at Coca-Cola, and there were people who had no time for me when I was a creative. And I didn't even know they thought I existed or knew I was. And the moment, you know, I was announced and I'm working at Coke and I go to industry events, all of a sudden these people are like, hey, agency people, like creative directors and ECDs, people who just... they had no time for me. All of a sudden, it's like, hey, Kaya, how are you? You know, it's like it's this very transparent ass-kissing, if you will.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, is annoying. And as opposed to making genuine connections and not trying to be kissing ass. And what I realized when I was on, as well, something that made me very uncomfortable was how I'd go to a meeting and how people were acting. They were serving me, right? It's like, do you have coffee? And I'm like, guys, it's okay. I can get my own coffee. And what I don't enjoy, and I think what is wrong, is this where clients feel that, you know, my agency is here to... I'm the master and they are the servant.
You'll continue. Just on that note, because I'm on the agency side, right?
Yes.
And being on the agency side, I realize that there's this, like this, someone in one of our earlier episodes referred to it as this power imbalance between the client and the agency, right? And how the levers are stacked more towards the client than the agency. So it's not a sort of 50-50 kind of partnership.
Absolutely.
So to this point about feeling like you're being served, feeling like people are almost feeling as though they're not your equal or they're not your peer, how do we lower that kind of barrier? Because of course, you know, working in the agency, I want to please the client, but also I want to work with the clients, and I equally want to challenge the client in a way that still helps us keep the business. How do you balance that? How, and now looking back from the lens of the client, having been on the other side of serving the client yourself, how do you think we could strike that balance?
You know what? It's funny you should say this because I remember when I was a client, we were shooting another client when I was a creative. Because as creatives, I was a young creative, so I didn't interact too much with clients, and I never really had to kiss ass with the clients. And because what they would do, they would always keep the creatives away from the clients because I don't know if they thought we were like ungovernable and unruly children. And we were shooting this ad. I'm shooting the ad. The script has been approved and all of that. And out of the blue, before we shoot the second ad the following day, the client who was not at the shoot has some complaint about some, suddenly wants to change the script. And they've recorded part of it already. And I got so mad. And I was like... I literally, during the thing, and I was like, but why would you change that now? And I did ask you, and I mentioned several objections that I'd said to her before that we could work on this. And then all of a sudden, when it's recording, it's going to push everything out.
Yes.
The consequences of what she required were so much bigger than she cared to understand.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No matter how I tried to explain it to them, and I kind of spoke to her like, "Come on, like," and I'm a junior. I'm like 20. I don't know. I was like 24, 23. I don't remember 24, 25. And I can see the client service director in the room like, "Kaya, like, calm down." we had a debate, a proper discussion,
yes.
Because I was. For me, I felt I was working on the interest of the brand and not necessarily for what I felt on her end. It was what she liked rather than what makes sense for the brand. And this is the big problem that I think agencies sometimes do, is that they look, okay, this client likes these sorts of things.
Yes.
And therefore, we need to create this kind of work because the client likes this kind of work rather than what serves the brand. So what is, like, you are not serving the client, you are serving the brand, the product, whatever it is that you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget that a lot, and that's the biggest frustration. And so when I have debates, I want those debates about, okay, what is working, what is not working, rather than trying to second guess the things that I like.
Sure.
But then at the same time, you have clients who are very egotistical. Who the work is about, you are serving me, it's about me, and therefore I'm always right, and they don't like to be challenged. But then when things go wrong, it's the agency's fault.
That's the essence of it, and I think that pretty much sums it, that when things go wrong, it's the agency's fault, but when things go right, it's because of the
brilliance of the marketer.
The brilliance. Yeah, exactly, right? So because as the agency, a lot of the time, you always go back to their strategy. You're like, yeah, but this is the guiding document that we started out with, and our true north is helping you to reach these objectives, but very much sometimes like, people in leadership positions we see it a lot in politics, right? Where it's like, yeah, but this is my tenure and that's where I think we should go, even though there's this true north. So how do you balance this from inside the brand such that the agency itself is able to have that partnership and a partnership that works well, especially with a new client? Because you can't, because I know that you want to have debates because I've seen you having debates all across. A lot of the marketers inside clients, I wouldn't know that they want to have debates. You don't know what kind of person you're dealing with. How do you then bring up these debates for the benefit of Coca-Cola when you were heading up that team, right? Like, how does your agency broach these topics?
So what I would do is obviously I would My personal thing is that I wanted to have a relationship with the strategy team. I wanted to have a relationship with the creative team so that I could talk to them directly. I didn't want to go via client service. Because then there's a true and proper understanding of the intention of the brief. You can ask me any questions at any time. So the brief is done, written. You ask me questions about the brief. And then I would also have like teacher sessions. For me, teacher sessions are very important. So how you understand the brief, you send me the brief. Okay, great, this is perfect. This is what I meant. Fantastic. Then I would have, I mean, like on weekends, I'd get calls from the strategy team. They work on maybe like with the strategist, and it's like, yo, I had this thought, and they'll call me directly and talk to me about what I was thinking, and I'm like, yes, actually, yeah, precise. Oh no, or have massive debates, completely disagree, very passionately sometimes, where it seems like we're having a fight, but we're not. Sure, it's just that it's the work that we're talking about.
Yes,
and then at the end of the day, we get to a point where I'm like, oh, that's where we're trying to go, and everybody is happy with that because it's about what you're trying to serve, what you're doing. And then what I would do then, teacher sessions. So I'd be involved. Okay, teachers, this works, this doesn't work. Maybe if we try that. Because what I've heard from a lot of agencies is a lot of clients tend to, the last time they talk to you is the brief, and the next time they talk to you is when you present it. And that doesn't work. That is not a partnership. And then the agency is stupid. Why didn't they understand? Yes, because you didn't talk. And also there are very specific things that happen in the back end of the business, right, that you sometimes forget to mention in the brief. And then you want to blame the creative agency for your lack of communication, not just communication, but your lack of constant involvement with them.
Remembering
that this is a partnership. It is not like I'm saying this and therefore you must serve me. I'm very passionate about this. It's something that really, really frustrates me. And if I were to ever, and I often wonder what I'd be like if I were to go back to agency, understanding what I understand now. Because I think that says several things. Number one, I don't think agencies are paid enough. Number two, agencies are understaffed. And because they're understaffed, they are overworked. And there's lots of different brands that are working on and super stressed. And thirdly, clients are always, a lot of clients aren't paying enough attention to their own deadlines, so that they don't keep
they don't keep themselves honest to the timelines that you need to meet in order to get to that deadline.
Exactly. And so what they do is it's like, okay, now someone hasn't responded to some questions for two weeks, they haven't said anything, but then now the deadlines, all of a sudden now the agency must jump around because you worry about the deadline that you have, but ignore them for 2 weeks. So it's this relationship that is messed up, where I'm powerful as a client, you weak as an agency, and because I know you need my business and you'll do anything to please me. And I think if agencies really became a lot more like a spine, the industry itself just needs to have a lot of spine, because we are all codependent on each other.
Sure.
And this power game is not conducive to creating great work, and not only that, into creating great partnerships as well. So for me, because there are two things I believe in: great partnership. That is my number one fundamental belief when it comes to dealing with my creative agent. I want to be a great partner, because if I'm a great partner, we will create great work together. That's what I want.
This episode is sponsored by the digitally led customer experience agency, Roger Wilco. For all your customer experience, digital marketing, and web development needs, go to rogerwilco.co.za or rogerwilco.co.uk. You can also download the South African CX Report and the Township CX Report directly from their website, free of charge. Don't we all love something free every now and again, especially with insights, right? Now back to the show. You've said very many things, some of which I'd like to go back to. The one is the money thing, that agencies are underpaid, or at least they're not paid as much as they should be for the kind of work that they deliver. How do you, in that sense, can you expand a little bit on that, actually?
Okay. So sometimes, I mean, and I think that's why sometimes agencies will add this fee here and that fee here, because they're trying to. But also, I think that there are sometimes, yes, maybe let me retract that and say, yes, sometimes agencies are underpaid. But secondly, agencies are also operating, it's like the silver 80s. Mm-hmm. So where the layers and layers of like, there's a client service this, there's a junior this, and there's a this, and do you need all of those things? And I almost feel like agencies, so what they do is that they bill clients.
Yes.
Because they have five people, yeah, working here. Sometimes you don't really need all of those people. But it's because that this is how the model has always been since the 80s. So we're keeping it this, because if we bill for, because we need to bill for all of these people who are working on this on this brand, and therefore it seems like then you're getting paid too little. Mm-hmm. But then if there is a lot of information that is, for example, now if I brief, let's go to the briefing.
Yes.
There is a BUD who's there, and maybe the person who is running the brand, the junior is not there in the room. The creatives are not, like, maybe there's a creative director or chief creative officer is in the room. There is the head of strategy, maybe the junior strategist. And then these people now go back to the agency and brief other people.
Right. Who weren't in the room, yeah.
Who are not in the room. So these people are being briefed to so they don't have the context. They're given partial context, and it's broken telephone. Mm-hmm. Comes back. They think the work is fine. I see the work, but that is what I said. For me, it's all this back and forth that there needs to be a far closer relationship in terms of briefing with client and agencies, and that maybe the agencies don't need to have as many layers as they do as well.
Okay. I'm also getting a sense of that besides the change that you believe is needed in the agency model, there's also a sense that whoever owns the relationship with the client needs to be the person working directly with the client more often, because you mentioned that you would get calls from strategists, for instance, and on a normal day, it's not the strategist, right, who would call you. It's like you'd speak to client service. So
I don't want to be talking to client service. Why am I talking to client service? Not that there's anything wrong with client service.
Sure.
It's just that we are not going to speak the same language. And then I get frustrated, right? So that's why I'd rather have the direct relationship who is creating the work.
Okay.
Like, yeah. The strategist is not stupid. They understand what I'm saying. A creative is not dumb. They understand what I'm saying. So why does it need to be translated through a client service? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. What I can understand client service being in the room is then, okay, great. They have a clear understanding of what needs to be delivered, when, and so on, you know, and all, yes, of that's, yeah, very detail. Important.
Exactly.
But mm-hmm. They are not creating the work. I need to be talking to the people who are doing the work.
On another platform, you mentioned the importance of collaboration and the fact that many people are involved in the creation and improvement of an idea. You were talking about the Share a Coke campaign in that specific interview. What value have you seen in some of these internal collaborations inside brand, as well as the global ones where the idea, like with Share a Coke, went to Australia and it became this global hit? What have you seen as some of them, as some of the value in some of these collaborations?
Well, I think when I look internally, so obviously the Australia obviously, you know, began the, you know, the Share a Coke, and we took it and it kind of like blew, like we really blew the socks, you know, out of it. And what was amazing was working with the team internally. So where we're speaking, for example, we spoke to internal affairs, is that they call public affairs, where they'd go and talk to the government and go and meet the government because they're trying to find the, so where to go and find out. So basically what happened is that we had to figure out the most popular names from a certain time, age, you know, certain age group and all of that. Let's say between people born between this year and that year. And once that happened, we also had to try and figure out lots of other, you know, legalities around it. That's all very internal. And then you speak to your research agency where they go and look at what are the most popular names in a certain province, in a certain area. They've got to think about, okay, break down the racial makeup as well of those areas. So it does a very, very, like, complex process, you know, to work that out. So internally, there's a lot of that work. And then the second thing that we had to do was the, you know, when we did the ad, the Share a Coke ad, which was the Bobby, the dog running around.
Yes, yes.
So then there were these two young girls who were working. Knew the young girls, and I think I was meeting for the first time when they're presenting this idea to me. So these two young creators, and they present, and I love the idea, and I'm like, this is fantastic, brilliant. But the only problem is that I had some research done, and this particular research had said that black people don't like to have animals in ads, and the evidence was empirical. You could not deny it. Mm-hmm. Whenever there were animals in an ad, the ads performed poorly. It was incredible. And so, and this is where collaboration is important. So they present this thing and I'm loving it. And my creative director at the time says, Kaya, but why would you say you love this? Yes, I agree. It's a great ad, but research has shown that animals just don't work.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, well, that may be true. The research did say this. However, the difference is here, it's a dog doing what a dog does in Lukshin.
Yeah.
It's outside. It's running around. It's, except for the fact that, you know, it's reading names, if you can read. It's not sharing a bed with people. It's not licking people's faces. It's like, it's a dog being a dog.
Yes, yes.
You know, and this is what resonated. And also, obviously, the name of the dog kind of adds to it. And then of the dog was Bobby. As we know, every second dog, you know, Elokshini is Bobby. So which kind of added another layer to it. So this discussion and this collaboration between the agency, me defending the work of the agency, my marketing director trusting my defense and saying that, okay, great, what you're saying makes a lot of sense, even though the research says contrary, right, to what you say, we'll go and shoot the head. We shoot the ad, then we have to buy rights to some song. We record it. We re-record it because the original was going to be very expensive. Then marketing director sees the ad and we can hear the music. Then we play it against the original and she says, you know what, actually, stuff it. We're going to pay all the money we need to pay in order to get the original. So get the original. So it's this process that keeps changing throughout.
Yes, yeah.
And where lots of people have to make small decisions that are risky, number one, because this ad black people don't like Amazon ads. And to keep spending more money on this ad, they could fail dismally. So there was like a process of trust between the agency, to myself as a client, to my boss who was the marketing director, and you know, the director who was doing the work and who collaborated very extensively with the director of the ad, by the way. He was incredible. Very, very incredible. Great listener as well. My favorite directors are those who kind of listen, who are not very adamant about what they're saying. And he, incredible guy, Greg Gray. So collaboration is so important to making the work great and successful.
No, that's a great point. And I think when you put it with all these layers in mind, all the people who had to make all these different decisions alongside what you found to be a great idea in spite of what the research says, because a lot of the time we fall back on the data as the insights. Like there's this fine line that isn't struck between what's data and what's insight. Sometimes data is referred to as insight when it isn't, right? And
exactly. That is so true.
Yeah.
So if you don't have, that's very true. If you don't have the insights, and this is why I say that living life is very important, because it's easy that I think when you live life, data is a lot easier to interpret into insights.
Yes.
And like if I looked at the data, I promise you, Mongezi, I'm not kidding. When I can still see the graph, the things that work the most. For example, what is incredible, having food in ads, in your ad. So the data was like fantastic if you have food. And then when you break it down, when there's chicken in the ad even works better. Also, like if it's lots of vignettes, people don't follow the ad, it doesn't work. There are lots of things that were kind of like that. So but the fact that like animals was really no go. Do you know what happened to that ad? That ad became the best. It was the highest testing of the best scoring ad ever in the history of South Africa. Even though it had that animal, that dog in it.
Yeah.
And black people are supposed not to like animals in ads because we understood what the data actually, we interpreted what the data was saying. It's just that like, well, all these other animals are kissing people in the face, sharing beds with people, you know, that's why those didn't work. Because it's unrelatable to a lot of people.
Yes.
That's why those things didn't work.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Advertising and creative awards in recent times have generated a lot of debate. As an award-winning advertising maven yourself, who's also worked inside the brand, what are your thoughts? Where do you stand on the value of awards?
Well, there is data to show that creative brands, they've done this data I don't know how true it is now, but over like a number of years where they showed that the, like Ken, for example, the ads, the brands that won a lot performed very well. Like they performed better than the brands that didn't.
Right. So there's ROI to back it.
Yes. So the evidence, like you could see the stock, including stock price and all of those things, there was such a direct correlation between creative work that wins and the share price of the companies that win. Sure.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The brands that win. Mm-hmm. So I. You know, for me, I think look at the data.
Yes.
Discuss the data and not just debate and say, is there value in it or there isn't? Uh-huh. What does the data say?
Yeah, yeah.
We can debate until we're blue in the face.
If we don't have the data.
There
have been some brands, though, that whose work was in awards, but it never aired or never flighted, right? So, which is, again, another side of the data that we could then look at in terms of the performance, where it's just where these are ads for just award purposes, as opposed
to terrible.
Yeah, you know, and
that should not that for me, that it pisses me off when agencies do that.
Yeah, and
but also what happens is generally the major awards don't allow scam ads.
Yeah,
the major awards, they don't.
Sure.
Yeah,
you are constantly working on new ideas, and I'm sure that because you work on new ideas, both you know, both in your professional life as well as your personal life, you constantly have to vet and test some of these ideas. How do you decide that I'm going with this one, not that? How do you decide on which ones to pursue and which ones not to?
Well, I'm directed by the brand, you know, the brand vision and architecture.
Sure.
Or whatever different brands call it. It's like, okay, what is the North South of brand?
Yeah.
Okay. That's the number one thing I look at. Mm-hmm. And I look at is, does the story make sense in terms of the brand?
Yeah.
What are we trying to achieve with this communication? Are we trying to get sales, or is it just about brand love? What are we trying to achieve? Mm-hmm. So for me, I look at those, you know, what my brief actually said, the outcome should be. And that's how I make the decision about what works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
What are we supposed to achieve?
Yeah. And in terms of the stories that you tell and the books that you write and the content that you create, how do you make that determination? Because then there isn't, call it a true north that is brand driven. It's your own kind of true north, right? It's something like that. Like with your latest book, which is It's the Answers for Me. It's a different kind of book from anything else that you had written before. Not that all your other books were the same. I mean, just looking at everything that you've written, every single one of them is different. But I'm sure that for you to land at your most recent book versus anything prior to that, you also had to, you were toying around with many different ideas, as you've just mentioned, that there are many ideas and many things that you follow and pursue. How do you then decide that I'll go with this format, which is different from anything else from before and different from what the publisher that you work with would have also published from you?
Well, I mean, the answers for me was a very strange one, because it was obviously during lockdown, which is when we worked on that. And it was something that the publisher actually threw at me and said, why don't you turn these questions you're asking into a book? I mean, I was like, would it work? Would it work? I don't know, you know, because, and also I was like, but I wouldn't feel like I've written the book because it's what people are saying. So how do I even credit myself as a writer? You know, like for this, I had this massive debate, I think, about that book. But was, to be honest, it was an experiment for me, that book. I was like, and credit to the publisher, they were willing to go, you know, with the experiment. And yeah, so because I suppose if you don't try things, like, you know, how do you know? Like, so how will you know what to do if you don't try?
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show. You recently went back into content creation with your channel, Leave a Message with Kaya Langa. I love the conversations, by the way. I've watched I've watched all of them. What inspired that? What inspired you to go back to creating content and creating that kind of content?
So I think for me, it's because, number one, I have more free time on my hands now since I've been on sabbatical and I've left trying to figure out what I need to be doing. And so I wanted to talk to, you know, people I find interesting, who have interesting things to say. And it's mostly to talk to people who I think will have something for me. It's quite selfish. So it's what I can glean and learn from that person. sure. that I'm talking to, but also hopefully what the audience can also pick up from them, because there are lots of different, because a conversation can go like anywhere, you know, at any moment, at any time. And I know it's so funny. I know that it's called Leave a Message. But what I do know is that when people listen to a conversation, they don't say, look at the podcast and think, yeah, but the title of the podcast is this. Why, you know, you know, why does it not tie up to the end like the name of the podcast? Yeah. You know, people are just interested in what's being said. So it's not like an ad or where it's like, okay, here's the payoff line, the strategy, and therefore. But for me, it's mostly to get the philosophy behind the person I'm talking to.
Sure.
So what drives them? What are their beliefs? What is the thing that causes them to be the kind of person they are?
Yeah.
Rather than, okay, you did A and then you did B. Because I feel when you speak to what drives people and what's in them, you learn a lot more about why they are the way they are.
Sure.
And then you can learn, you can kind of figure out, actually, maybe these are some of the things I can apply in my own life, like one or two things that I'm learning from this person because of their philosophy.
Okay, no, that makes sense. I know that before you named the channel, you were toying around with a couple of ideas and you wanted to collaborate with your community. And I just want to now go back to this idea of storytelling and creating stories, which we started out with in the beginning when we started our conversation. And I think one of the things, of course, there was that I'm seeing is beyond telling stories of your life, your thinking, and the way that you landed where you are, it's also this story that looking back for nearly two decades of at the story of Kayalanga, it's like you constantly put building blocks on the public persona and the person that you are by creating the story. Was this deliberate from the beginning, or is this something that you kind of landed on?
It was not deliberate. For example, like when I, because I think I started my YouTube channel maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, it's crazy when you think about that. That's a long time. Yeah. I was literally the only South African on YouTube and some other racist guy.
Yeah. You found the crickets of YouTube in South Africa.
That's actually wrong of you to say he's racist. But he was very provocative, let me put it that way. And for me, just I was just curious about, because, for example, when I stumbled on YouTube, I was looking for some video. I don't know what video I was looking for. I don't remember. And then I just saw people talking to camera, like normal everyday people. Mm. And I figured, this is very interesting. Oh, why am I listening? And people are listening, they are commenting, they're responding to each other. This is what a great community. And I was like, let me be involved. Sure. I didn't have a camera. And I taught myself how to edit. And I remember the first video I put up, it took me, good Lord, it took me like 9 hours to edit it. I mean, sure. It was such a simple thing. Because there were no videos, because there were no YouTube videos that said how to edit on iMovie. You couldn't find it. It didn't exist. So you kind of figured out as you went along. And I was just creating content. It was a creative outlet. There was no big reason, you know, behind it. And then I suppose now when it comes to the books, for example, like what I think about when I was a copywriter, you know, I was writing ads because I enjoyed the creative output and also like, and I also think writing and creating, there's a part of you that is making yourself immortal, if you will.
Right.
Because you are living. When I die, my books will remain, right? And for however long, you know, that could be. And I think it is a sense of creating your own immortality when you create to a certain degree. And maybe we might not say that consciously. And while I enjoyed creating, making ads and winning awards, and but those seem very short-lived. You've won an award, okay, great, fantastic. People talk about a campaign. And then every now and then it's going to be shown as a, you know, the seminal thing. But if you are an artist, you know, and a celebrated artist, you know, kids will be taught about their artwork or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
I think that for me, writing books is possibly me trying my stake at immortality, even though I know that my books, you know, they're not like New York Times bestsellers and all of that. But I know that in 10 years or 20 years' time, someone is going to want to reference this era that we live in. And there's a book that, you know, I've written, and they will quote something from the book. You know what I'm saying? So I think it's for me, it is a chance at a brief immortality.
Yeah. You've also managed to create a community around yourself over time, right? So part of this storytelling, story creation, and content creation has enabled you to build a community around yourself, from that first YouTube video that you did 15 years ago to date, when you have when you are running your channel now, and you ask people what the channel should be, and you get lots of messages. One of the things that you've been able to create is a community around yourself. Over the years, how have you been able to manage these sort of community dynamics? Because you very much get into a space that, I guess, big brands get into, right? When they have a community manager. Like, how do you manage those dynamics of this community that you've managed to build?
I think for me, I think about, okay, I suppose I don't think about the community, if you will. It's just like, hey, I'm having fun. You know, I'm having a good time.
Sure.
And I think that if I'm having a good time, so are they.
Hmm.
But it's very interesting. It also depends. It's interesting while I'm talking to you, I'm thinking about the various platforms. And weird enough, the platform I'm thinking about the least is Twitter.
Okay.
Because of how toxic I find it. Mm-hmm. And even though it was the one of the places where I kind of, you know, blew up, you know.
Yes.
It was a great platform. And so what it's become, it's just been very, very strange animal. Mm-hmm. And so I hesitate, you know, to go on there as much as I used to. Right. And I don't tweet as much as I used to. I don't say as much as I used to because of what, you know, that platform has really become and is becoming. And then Instagram, on the other hand, is a lot more, I wouldn't say forgiving, but it feels more like a community, like a real community that is not out there for harmful purposes.
Yeah. Like, it's not as malicious.
It's not malicious. And that's what it is. And I suppose the same thing with YouTube now, so far, at least my experience.
Yeah.
So it also depends on which audience you are speaking to, I imagine.
Right.
But I don't have, but I do hope they support the things that I do. And fortunately, you know, they're buying my books, they're watching my videos. They are, so I'm grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. So Kaya, you've done it all, from agency to brands to award winning work at agency and on the brand side, to content creation. What are your thoughts on how content creators can improve their chances of partnering with brands and agencies? What do you look for as a marketing executive who's been both on the brand side and the agency side, as well as having been a content creator yourself? Like, how can you, anybody else as a content creator, kind of stick out and be visible to the kinds of brands I want to partner and work with?
Well, I think one, I think there's a mistake that brands are not, you know, is there are fans, there are people that are like your fans as a brand, and they create content around your brand. And most brands do not reward those creators. And I almost feel like, well, there is a reason that maybe hundreds or thousands of people are resonating with that person while they are talking about your brand. Even if you have not, for example, I would, if I were to go back and be a client, I would have a budget on the side that is specifically for those creators we did not plan for, who've done things so that I can reward them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And secondly, I would say that brands tend to say, okay, we want one post and you must do this and it must. It's too restrictive to the to the creator as opposed to providing like a guideline.
Sure.
And now I'm posting something that is so contrary to my personality and to who I am, and then it doesn't connect, doesn't resonate, because, and now you're disappointed because it didn't connect or resonate. Yeah, because you're trying to make me sound like you.
Yes,
but it came to me because I sound like me.
Mm-hmm.
And that process of co-creation, I think, is underappreciated. And because the reason people connect with certain creators is because there's a realism that they appreciate about those people.
Yes.
A lot of the time when brands are involved, they try to sanitize the realism that you have as that creator. Mm-hmm. And that is a big problem, I think. So, but and while, yes, brands need to be protected, and there are certain guidelines that they need to adhere to, brand standards and all of those things. But man, a lot of the times, when I cannot tell you the number of times I have said no to brands because I'm like, but this is not me. It's not going to sound like me. It's not going to feel like me.
Yeah.
And it's not authentic. I can't do it.
Mm.
I can't do it. Though I was recently, I was approached for some Forex thing. I was like, I don't know. Number one, I don't understand Forex. But I can see now that lots of influencers were participating in this thing the last two weeks or 3 weeks. I was like, I don't understand Forex. I've never been involved in it. A part of me feels that there's a bit of a scam work involved in it. So I was like, I don't want to go and promote this thing that I don't understand. Yeah. Even though the money was really nice, I had to say no. Mm. And so I will only get involved with brands that I think, okay, I get it, I understand, except. But a lot of creators don't have that, maybe the luxury, because I had a job and I was working, and I have the luxury to say no, to brands approaching me. Yeah, it's not my core thing. And you have quite a lot of influencers, if you will, whose main job is that. And for example, I got upset with an institution I won't mention. Sent me an email a few years ago. They sent me an email. They wanted me to be involved in this campaign. And then I'll never forget this at the end of the brief, which was, and what's your involvement? Yes. And how do we say thanks to you? Oh, you'll be one of the first owners of da 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 and association with this great brand. I was livid. And I sent an email back and I said, guys, you are a listed company, number one. Number two, most creators, there are a lot of people who are not in the position that I am in, and they are creators. They rely on this for their rent. Like association, brand association is not going to pay for their rent. Brand association is not going to fill their stomach. You know what I'm saying? Because you are going to get, you understand that there is a value that they provide, but for some reason you don't want to pay them for the value that they're providing. And I was like, I'm not going to be involved in this campaign. I was so mad. And I mean, why would you say that when you are a listed company? And one of your core values, what also upset me, was that, you know, they're trying to get South Africans to have a better understanding of their finances and do that. But if you're talking about money and they're not going to pay them, what is this?
That's a really important question to ask a brand, a really important conversation to have, because some of these brands want to work with content creators. They want the content, and for the benefit that they get, aren't willing to put anything on the table to enable said content creators to grow. So it's really great that you pose that question and you put that forward. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode for this really riveting and insightful conversation. A lot of our listeners, in fact, all our listeners and viewers, will find this conversation really valuable. And I'm sure that all of us will be following your next move and will watch your content on your Leave a Message channel. Thank you very much for making the time.
Awesome. Thanks, Ongeze.
And thank you for making the time to watch and listen to this episode. It really makes a huge difference. One other thing that really makes a difference is if you share this episode, subscribe to our channel, subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and please leave us a review. Leave us a short review, leave us a comment, because it really helps to build the audience, to spread the message, and more importantly, to bring really interesting and riveting guests that we can talk to and share their insights with you. Thank you for watching and listening to The Lead Creative. Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. Pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mongezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on mongezi.com.